The gurus of how to, Alvin and Lawrence U. Bell, are here, also known as Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. They visit us once a month to deal with all sorts of do-it-yourself matters. Is it do-it-yourself, or sometimes telling people they can't do it themselves?
It's not only do-it-yourself. It's really we have to contend with life's troubles and the mechanical world that's about us and live within these mechanical world and all the sophistication that goes on and with engineers and architects and chemists and mathematicians and everything else. And maybe we could help you out a little bit on that.
So you see yourself as the equivalent of a psychotherapist, only in this case dealing with the more mechanical end of life?
Well, I actually see us more as a general practitioner or an internist. We don't do brain surgery, but we know when you need a brain surgeon. We don't do, cardiology, but we know when to send you to a cardiologist. And that's really what it comes down to, because the problem is a lot of people go for their consulting through their vendors, whether that be a plumber, an electrician, a roofer. And if your roof leaks and you call an electrician, it's because your wiring is bad. And so they tend to look at the world through their particular focus, where we tend to look at the entire building and try to guide you to which one of these people. Also, the problem is that vendors don't make money for consulting. They only make money for selling. We make our living by consulting, and we want you to spend less, and we try to get you to go in the right direction in that respect. And that's where the difference is. But I also want to say one thing. I just got back from the American Society of Home Inspectors convention, which was in Atlanta, which was no warmer than it is here. But I always come back with something new that excites me. In this particular case, it's carbon monoxide.
You're excited by carbon monoxide.
Well, excited on how to save people.
He's jumping up and down with carbon monoxide.
How to actually protect people. And one of the people this gentleman named Steve Wisdom, brought up an interesting concept. And on Thanksgiving, the holiday when we all cook the most and our ovens are on, our stoves are on for 4, 5, 6, 7 hours. And also here in the Northeast and most other places, no one opens up a window. The air is stagnant. And some of these stoves and ovens and cooktops can produce between 100 and 700 parts per million of carbon monoxide.
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 Not dioxide.
Not monoxide.
Just one, not two.
Just a single. And just so you know, the OSHA limit is 30 parts per million for, limitation.
You know that I'm so grateful that there's always a guest who says, it's hot in here. Can we open a window?
Right. And
I didn't know they were saving my life.
Yes.
Well,
creating a draft.
Or extending or accelerating your senility.
Yeah, but does it really have an effect on us?
Well, he posed an interesting question. If you go out to a restaurant and you eat turkey, do you feel sleepy? But how can we all feel sleepy at the end of are we all suffering from carbon monoxide poisoning? Because we haven't opened up a window, these ovens are, and the thing why we don't tend to take it seriously is because carbon monoxide has a half-life in your blood of about 5 hours. So once we stop cooking and everything goes back to the way it was, the levels in the house drop as they do in your system. But what's even scarier is that if you have a piece of equipment producing about 40 to 50 parts per million, carbon monoxide detectors only go off at 70 when it's been that way for an hour for 4 hours. So you can be dosing yourself at a lower level. The carbon monoxide detector never goes off. And because you never leave the house, if you're a home-ridden person or you're just in all day, you could die from carbon monoxide poisoning and no alarms will ever go off.
I always thought it was just simply something that happened when car exhaust fumes.
No, it could happen from real low levels. And people need to take this seriously. And I just want to say one other thing, because I know my dad's dying to jump in. But New York City law does not require cooktop ventilators if you have a window in a room. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't know anybody in the middle of the winter or even the summer who's opening up a window every time they start cooking. Nobody does.
But I do have a cooktop ventilator.
But does it ventilate to the outside?
I have no idea.
That's another thing.
It just makes a lot of noise, and
right.
I hardly ever use it.
And I am definitely pushing that regardless of the windows, regardless of the codes, because I don't really care about the codes, because the codes can be somewhat politically written. So I would like to see people either opening windows or when you're cooking, turn it on a little. It doesn't have to be blasting. Just get a couple of CFMs, changes per minute, of air in your home. and everyone will be a lot healthier.
Yeah, that also goes to people who, this time of weather, that people are not getting enough heat from their landlord, and they use their stovetops because sometimes the bill is being paid by the building.
The oven as well creates
the oven, right. That is producing carbon monoxide, and it's also putting in a lot of carbon dioxide, and it's also putting a lot of moisture into the building, and you have mold all over the place. And it's very dangerous. What happens while you're asleep, all of a sudden there's a low-pressure situation in the gas system, and the pilot light goes off, and the gas goes off, and then all of a sudden it comes back on. It just takes an instant. The furnace down in the basement there that all of a sudden needs to fire up, and it's a big boiler, and it draws more gas than it's supposed to. Your pilot light and everything else goes off, and you could be asphyxiated.
Wow.
So it's you got to be conscious of what's going on about you.
Is there such a thing as carbon trioxide?
Yes, carbon trioxide really comes from the decomposition and turns to sulfuric acid. So that's that's a little chemical thing.
But you also
– it's really a big chemical thing.
Also, one thing you need to look for is when – is also other – there are also a lot of other things we – and I could speak for hours about this, but and which I don't want to do. But also the fact that when you look at a flame, unless it's that beautiful blue flame, it could be producing – so when you turn up the flame and it's slapping up against the bottom of your pan or your pot and it's those yellow tips, that's carbon monoxide.
And it's also some carbonization on the bottom of the pot or it's flickering. That's a big problem.
I want to remind our listeners that our phone number here is 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Go to the WNYC site, and then look for the Leonard Lopate show, and then you'll see get directions as to how to leave a comment.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing, when you come by, we always have a quiz as well, and you wonder who wants to read
the
quiz?
Yes, I'll take this quiz. It's okay.
You're going to take the quiz? You think you'll pass?
I'll give the quiz, yes.
Oh, okay.
I know the answer.
Oh, good. That always helps.
name the finished end or end fascia or trim on the end of a pitched gable roof. Occasionally, it will be an elaborately ornamental piece of wood that's put on that gable end or just a flat piece of trim. We're looking for the name of that end piece.
Okay. And a number again, 646-829-3985, to speak to the gurus of how to, Alvin and Lawrence U. Bell. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's go to our first caller, who is Benin from Valley Stream. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have no boiler at the moment. I have a gas-powered steam system. Boiler failed, long sad story.
Yeah.
But at this point, I have a choice between two technologies, one using neoprene gaskets and one using cast iron push nipples. And well, I don't know which one to go with.
I would go with the push nipples.
Okay.
Yeah, especially
which brand are we talking about?
Burnham uses push nipples, and Weil McLain uses neoprene gaskets.
Right. That's right. Slant Fin also uses the push nipples. This also depends upon.
Are we going to get into some trouble with the FCC by having this conversation?
It depends on what words we use around that.
Yeah. Okay.
The thing.
I just want to keep abreast of this all this material.
The thing is, your steam. Did you say your system is a steam system or a hot water system?
It's steam.
Steam. So you have to go with the push nipples because what happens if you ever have a low water condition in a steam boiler, you will melt out the neoprene fittings between the sections of the boiler.
Now I'm going to recommend something to make your system a little bit better and a little safer.
Okay.
I would like to actually see a second – it probably comes with an internal low water cutoff.
Yes, it does.
I'd like a secondary external low water cutoff and – it probably comes with a pressure switch. I would like to see a pressure switch with a manual reset. That way, if the pressure switch breaks or the relief valve breaks, you have another level of protection. So ask your plumber to upgrade for those things. It will probably only cost you a couple hundred dollars, and it's worth it.
Okay, but a secondary low water cutoff.
Right, an external one.
And how do you feel about the automatic water feeders?
I like them because the new ones work better. Make sure they put on a backflow protector.
Okay.
Okay, and your clock just went off. Thank you so much for your call, by
that's
the
a
way.
Good, that was a good question.
A follow-up is from Amy in New Rochelle. She writes, we need to replace our oil burner boiler. Mm-hmm. Do you recommend staying with oil or changing to gas? Also, if we convert to gas, we need to install a liner in the chimney. How do we find a reputable company?
Okay, first of all, the changing of oil to gas or gas to oil, in my opinion, is really purely economic. They both work well. If the, both systems are working well, you shouldn't have a problem with either one. As far as lining the chimney is concerned...
Wait, which one's cheaper?
It depends on what the economics are at the time. I mean, gas does tend to be a little more expensive because you're paying for the delivery system. Mm-hmm. I always use the analogy. The difference between oil and gas is that if you, you know, when the oil company goes on strike, you get cold. When the gas company goes on strike, you get an estimated bill. And so you may—that's really the difference. People are concerned about fires. Really, the amount of fires or explosions that you have in even this country, you can count on. You don't need many hands for that. So that's not a concern for me. So really, it really is economics. What you can get oil for? How you can—that's really. And also the oil tank. Is the oil tank buried under the ground and is it becoming an environmental problem? So there are a lot of factors. And as far as lining the chimney, I would definitely have a second opinion on the chimney. A lot of people these days are having their chimneys lined that are not necessary because it's a good way for chimney companies to make a quick $1,000 or whatever. Lining a chimney, that's perfectly fine. So you really need to have someone reputable give you an opinion about that.
Thank you. We go now to Anna Marie from Yonkers.
Yes.
Hi, Anna Marie.
Hi, Anna.
Good afternoon.
Yes,
I hope that you can kindly help me. I plan to redo our roof this year and replace it. And we have two dormers in the back of the house.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking, for the sake of not having to paint them in the future, to instead continue with the shingle on the side where one would usually put the siding.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on it, and how would one proceed? And do you have to put liners or a copper piece right where the two come together, sheeting or something?
In other words, where you have a valley coming together, where you have the dormer coming in, intersecting with the actual pitched roof area.
Or are you talking about the dormer end where the that's not the roof but is the siding around that?
I was talking where the flat piece comes and touches the roof piece that goes down, the wall of where I usually have the shingles.
Okay.
And it does have a pitch going down, yes.
Mm. It does have a pitch. Well, for many years, they used to use the copper flashing in order to make that interface between two different angular pieces. Or later on, they started to use aluminum, which was really very bad because it used to deteriorate. Now they have what they call a material called modified bituminous, which actually is a strips of asphaltic material which can be laid in the valley, and that could probably last almost forever. And so you have to ask the roofer to use the new modern technology of using this modified bituminous pieces.
But you know what? I'm not sure if we're answering your question because I'm not getting a great visual of what you're describing, which that's one of the problems with construction and buildings is we all have to use the same terminology. But what I would like you to do is take pictures of the things that you want, and you could send them to me at larry@accuratebuilding.com or larry@ubell.com.
And include
a phone number, and I will look them over, and I will give you a more definitive opinion because I don't think we're answering your question, and I'm not sure what the question
is. Okay,
Emery?
All right, but you're speaking to a snail. Do you have a telephone number?
Telephone number is 718-265-8191.
Thank you so much for calling us, and we go now to Alan from New York. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi, Alan.
Hi, I was wondering if these shower heads that are supposed to increase water pressure actually work.
Well, water pressure has to do a lot of things. It has to do with the actual static pressure of the city equipment or the pumping equipment that happens to be built into the building. Usually it's around 50 to 60 pounds, but it also has to do with the age of the piping and the kind of piping, which may have add frictional resistance to the piping system and the water flow. As far as the shower head itself, the more restrictive the shower head is at the disbursement end of it, the higher the pressure will be because you're really reducing down and you get like a needle shower. What they do put into the shower heads now is flow restrictors in order so that you use less water. And it's a combination of things. Each system that you have has to be thought about as per the valve that you happen to be buying.
But what about the efficient ones, the ones that supposedly save you, you know, cut back on water? Mm-hmm. But aren't they cutting back on water pressure as well?
Yeah, no, they don't cut back on the water pressure. What they do is they restrict the amount of water that comes through. But sometimes they, if they restrict it too much, it restricts it lower than the actual delivery orifice on the shower head itself. So what happens is then you get less water. If the water was a larger pipe, which you have a great deal of volume, and the pressure was like 50 or 60 pounds, and you'd have a normal kind of shower head, you would be having a needle shower. Everything gets restricted down, and it has to. The system has to do with the system itself.
One other thing I want to say is that the shower head does not increase the pressure.
No.
It just makes it feel like it's more pressure. Okay, unless there's a pumping station inside the shower head, which I heavily doubt. It really can't increase the pressure. It just makes it feel like more. And I have to tell you that, you know, they have these what do they call them? Those rain heads that lots of water, and you got to get. And it's basically the way those work is just a lot of water coming through it. The whole problem with a shower heads, it's really a trial and error kind of thing. You got to find the head you like, and sometimes you have to go through a few of them. So if you're good, you buy one, you unwrap it carefully, you try it out. If you don't like it, you clean it, you shake out the water, put it back in the wrapping, and bring it back.
Whoa. Well, there are a lot of shop owners right now who are very happy to hear you say that.
But you know what? No one, you don't really know because they make a whole lot of claims, and you're just a babe in the woods trying to figure out what to do.
Lily in Manhattan writes, can my landlord force me to keep my window guards? I have no children and no children visit, and the window guards are blocking my view from my window.
No, but he may require you to sign off on that.
Well,
liability.
In actuality, once the window guards are put in by a prior tenant, you can't take them off. That the law says you got to leave them there forever, and the landlord is responsible. The tenant is responsible for making sure that it's in good repair by telling the landlord that it's in disrepair. In other words, the landlord is responsible for the maintenance and the upkeep and the installation of those window guards. Once they're in, they remain as part of the building. That's the way the law is.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, take more calls here. And also, take your comments on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are the gurus of How To, Al and Larry Ubell, also known as Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. Stay with us. And we're back with the gurus of How To, Al and Larry Bell, and we're taking your calls at 646-829-3985. Also, you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. I'll read a couple of the comments. Oh, we have the quiz, and maybe we should go to somebody who thinks he knows the answer. Mike from Morris County, what do you think it is?
I think it's flashing.
Plashing?
Yeah.
No.
Is that what Bobby Darin did? Plish plash?
The flashing may be part of this piece that it may hold it in place and worked around. But flashing is a different element of what we are talking about, the end fascia of a gable, and it has a specific name.
So this person is probably wrong as well. Lou, you think it is fascia?
Well, I think it's rake fascia.
Rake fascia.
No, it's not. It is the fascia piece, but that fascia on the end of a gable or a gabled roof or a dormer has a specific name.
And we already gave the word fascia in the description, so that can't be it.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
We're looking for a different word.
Yeah, well, I hate to face you with these kinds of calls. But anyway, Joseph in the East Village writes, I've been wanting to remove my plaster wall and expose the brick and then paint it. Would you recommend – oops, somebody just played with my computer here. Well, would you recommend doing it myself or hiring an outsider? The building was renovated in the 1970s.
Well, I tell you, it's a dirty job to clean the brick off and make sure it's nice and clean and everything else. And then when you get it really nice and clean and point in some of the missing mortar that may be between the bricks, then you have to give it at least one or two coats of polyurethane in order to keep the dust from the brick and the mortar from drifting into your apartment. It is a big job, and there are commercial people that do it, and they know how to ventilate the place. They put down tarpaulins and take all the schmutz out of the apartment.
But you can't just go at it with a hammer?
You can. And actually, the thing is if it's which is more valuable to this individual, his time or his money. And if he has the time and he has the desire and the wherewithal to do it, by all means, go crazy.
Go crazy. That's absolutely.
Yeah.
We go now to Susan from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Regarding the carbon monoxide detector, it sounded as though when we purchase one, it's not at the you were saying that they're not going up to the level that is needed. Is there
No.
I'm looking for one, and I want to know the best one I should
get. They're all set to react at 70 parts per million for between 1 and 4 hours. So but it has to maintain that 70 parts per million. The problem is that if they made them lower, a lot of them would be going off all the time and showing false positives. But on the other hand, they're also putting us in a risk condition where if we only have 40 parts per million for a prolonged period of time and you don't leave the house and you don't have an opportunity to get the half-life of the carbon monoxide that's in your blood out, then you can actually suffer from carbon monoxide poisoning where the carbon monoxide detectors didn't go off. So what I'm really saying is that buildings, homes, apartments need better ventilation. We're all concerned of keeping the heat in, but sometimes to the expense of our own health. And so you have to be – but one thing I didn't say, that if all of a sudden you start feeling sick in your home for really no apparent reason, you tend to be drowsy or you tend to have a headache, and everyone in the house feels exactly the same way, don't think it's something you ate. Don't think it's the flu. Try an experiment. Go outside for a while and see what happens. It could be that something in your home is creating a high carbon monoxide condition, and it needs to be evaluated. Just one quick story is that someone I know who does this kinds of inspections, walks around with a personal carbon monoxide detector on his body. He opens the door. He wants to do the evaluation of the home. The mother and the child say, we're not really feeling that well today. Can we do this another time? He stepped one step closer to the door, and his carbon monoxide detector went off. So they were living in a very high condition, and none of the detectors went off. So I don't mean to frighten everyone. I don't want anyone running around with, Chicken Little. But you have to be aware of your conditions. You have to be aware yourself of how you feel.
We have Louis from – or Louis. I don't know whether it's Louis Louis – from
Louis,
Hartsdale,
Louis.
Mm-hmm. With an answer to the quiz, which is, by the way, name the finished end, the end fascia trim on the end of a pitched gable roof. Occasionally it will be elaborately ornamental or just a flat piece of trim. What do you say it is?
Hi, Louis from Hartsdale. Pork chop?
Pork chop?
Yeah.
No.
I
never heard
have
that.
Have you ever heard of a pork chop? And you actually built these things.
Yes, I built a lot of that. I never heard that term before.
Local 11, we used to build houses up in Bedford Hills and stuff. It was like a pork chop at the end of the gable. It's like a finished piece of wood.
Well, that sounds like a local name, but I see it's trying to describe exactly what the true name is, what the architectural name is. And that's what we're looking for. Maybe I should put it, this is called the architectural name for that particular piece of trim.
But thanks for calling.
Let's try another person who's trying his luck. Doug from, is it Fordham Park?
Florham.
Florham Park, hi. What do you think it is?
Would it be rake?
No, that's the slant of the roof is called the rake.
Mm-hmm.
The rake of the roof, that's called the slant. But this is something that follows the rake of the roof, but it's attached to the face of the gable.
Chris from Madison, New Jersey, what do you think?
Well, if it's not rake board, which a lot of builders call it, then it's maybe an old-fashioned term, barge board.
And that would be the one we were looking for.
Okay.
It's called a barge board or barge board.
Now, how did you know that, Chris?
I'm an architect.
Ah!
That's cheating.
Well, all the regular people didn't get it, so.
Well, Chris, we have a prize for you.
Yes, we go. The Save Energy, Save Money by Al Ubell and George Merlis. We need your name and your address.
Yeah, don't give it to me now. I'm going to put you on hold, and my producer will take all of that information, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. And we have some other people who have questions. This George on Long Island asks, he has new hot water pipes that are made of PEX. And they were installed right next to a gas line. Now he notices that the gas pipe is getting as hot as the water pipes. Is that unsafe? Mm. The plumber that did the work hasn't showed up to inspect them, but says on the phone that it's fine.
If it's next to a – what I think he's talking about is the vent connector or the stack that connects the heating equipment to the chimney, and there is a schedule of separation, and if it's a single – if it's a single wall, it's 6 inches. If it's a double wall, I believe it's 2 or 3 inches away. So it should be at least 2 or 3 inches away, unless it's a triple wall, which is highly unlikely. So at least 2 or 3inches away.
And if it isn't, then this thing was installed incorrectly.
It's installed incorrectly. But you have to know what the materials are and what the clearances are. But it shouldn't be touching.
Does it matter that it's made of PEX?
PEX? Yeah, PEX. That's cross-link polyethylene. And that's a new material they're using for both heating pipes and for domestic water. It comes in blue and red. Blue is for cold. Red is for hot.
Laura from Queens. Hi, you're on the air. Laura, are you there?
Are you there,
yes,
Laura?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
My refrigerator keeps getting slower and slower. It doesn't keep the food cold. And I was wondering if there's somebody told me that it's Freon gas that has to be refilled or something.
Not necessarily, because usually.
Well, let me ask a quick question. How old's the refrigerator?
3 years.
Oh, okay. Go on.
Well, that not necessarily. Sometimes there is a heat exchanger that's on the outside of the refrigerator that is clogged up with dirt or dust. It's either on the bottom or it's on the back that has to be vacuumed cleaned away. Usually, when you have a diminished amount of refrigerant in a compressor, what happens is the freezing compartment of the refrigerator overfreezes. And what happens is the food compartment does not get enough cold in it because the ice on the coils is so thick that they can't absorb any heat anymore.
Would that be on a new refrigerator, Al?
Well, there could be a leak. There's no question. But I would first check the heat exchanger.
In other words, what you're saying is, I know he's using fancy word. He's using fancy book learning terms, but it's basically the coil.
The coil.
The external coil on the whether it's at the bottom or the back. Sometimes
there's a big coil on the back. Goes from like the top to the bottom.
Right. It should be vacuumed. Try that first.
I did. I tried. I brushed it off, and it's still. Then the freezer works. That's so strange.
Well, then the other thing that could be taking place is that there is a little fan that is in the compartment between the freezing compartment and the food compartment, and that fan could be clogged up with dirt
or broken
or not working anymore, and it's not taking the cool. It's not absorbing the heat that's in the food compartment and putting it into the freezing compartment. It's like an absorption kind of condition. It is complicated, but you may have to call a serviceman to take a look at that.
I would call the serviceman or just call up the company that made it and say that it's 3 years old. It should still be working. Okay?
Okay,
thank you for calling us.
No problem.
Joy from Manhattan is on the line now. Hi, Joy.
Yes. What do I do to use a liquid deglazer? What kind of liquid deglazer where I want to have acrylic paint over what was oil base?
You have an if it's an acrylic paint over an oil-based paint, the thing is that
that's never a good idea.
It's not a very good idea. I don't know what the underlining thing is. That on wood or porcelain? What is it?
On plaster and or wood.
On wood. That may take. I would experiment in a small corner with some paint remover You can buy some paint remover in any hardware store and just take a small container of it and just experiment in one little corner that is not and see if it removes the paint readily. The best kind, the one, is the water-soluble paint remover. It's easy to work with, and it's not hazardous. But that's
but it's also water-soluble because she has an acrylic paint there.
That's right.
I was taught in art school that you could paint oil paint over acrylic paint, but you couldn't paint acrylic paint over oil paint.
You can paint acrylic over water, but you have to put in – you have to sandpaper or scratch up or scuff the oil-based paint so that it adheres to it and locks in to the acrylic paint that's there already.
We go now to Ted from – where is this? From Astoria?
Yeah.
Hi, Ted.
Hi, Ted. What's up?
On my heater, there's – I think it's a hot water heater. I'm not totally sure. It's, you know, there's a long pipe that goes floor to ceiling that connects to the iron heater. And on the heater, there's like a – it looks like kind of like the hat the Pope wears. Like it's a triangular thing, and it leaks water like crazy. It's maybe that's
is that on the side? Is that on the side? When you mean the heater, you mean the radiator?
Oh, the side of the radiator.
Okay, the radiator. And it's about halfway down the side of the radiator?
Yeah, right.
And it leaks water all the time? Okay, or it spits water out. Yeah, that's the air vent. It's the steam vent or the air vent, and it's broken, and it needs to be replaced. And they're easy to replace. You could just you shut off the valve feeding into the radiator, let the radiator cool off, and then unscrew it, go to the hardware store, grab a new one, get some Teflon tape, and screw it back into position, and it should work.
Oh, wow. That's great. Thank you.
It's very easy.
The other thing about air valves, steam air valves spitting water, that sometimes is that the shutoff valve at the radiator may be half open or half closed, and it's building up water and it's squirting up to the...
Well, actually, what happens is sometimes if it's all the way closed, there's actually a little pinhole intentionally in the seat of the valve, so it lets some air in, and then the radiator becomes waterbound.
That's right.
Right.
And the water squirts out when every so often because it's leaking through.
Mm-hmm. That could also be going on.
Ian from Rockaway Beach. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
What's
are
up?
You? I'm calling because I just have a question. If there is a particular agency or any one source that I can turn to, the situation is like this. My wife and I were separated, and he lives in two different houses, and
yes,
he's developed an asthmatic condition. So it seems that every time he comes back from her house, his condition worsens. And then he gets better when he's in my house, and then he goes back to her house, and again, the same
okay
thing.
I'm and, not – we're not hygienists, and we're not – but I would –
You're not – and you're not marriage counselors?
Well,
no,
that's
no,
for
but,
that's for dang sure. Anyway, but here's the situation. The asthma can be from so many different things, and I would really – refer you that it's not an agency. I would go talk to his physician and say and describe what's going on. It could be a number of things. It could be it could be environmental issue. It could be carbon monoxide in the air.
It could be dust mites.
It could be dust. It could be dust mites. It could be smoking. It could be so many different things that for me to guess what it is. But it obviously, if this is going on, there is an environmental component, and one has to be more of a detective. I understand the problem is that how do you do this kind of investigation with, when he's at the mom's house and the mom's going to saying, you know, it's obviously there's a political problem right there. What am I do? You're accusing me of hurting my son. So obviously there's an issue there, but it's good. You got to take him to the doctor when he's with you and talk to the doctor and find out what's going on and maybe move another step forward. But one of the things it could be is asthma is definitely exacerbated by environmental conditions such as carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, dust, all these different issues, and they got to be dealt with.
Thank you so much for your call. We have run out of time. We will be seeing you again on March 16th, Wednesday. But a reminder that if people want to get in touch with you, Larry,
yes,
what do they do?
They can definitely write me at larry@ubell.com or larry@accuratebuilding.com.
Or check our website.
Check our website. We actually have a new service where you can just find our name and just send us something, and I get that in the email. But
people have to know how to spell your name, U-B-E-L-L.
Right.
You'd be amazed at some of the spellings I see.
But even if you spell it wrong, Google says, do you mean? And you get it right. But definitely you want to include telephone numbers. And if you have a condition that needs photographs, take pictures. That way we're both on the same page when I make the first phone call.
So that at least you can have some sense
of
what it looks like.
What's going on.
And I want to thank you both so much for being with us, Alvin and Lawrence U. Bell of Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. You'll be back on March 16th, as I said. When?
And we're going to go forth and fix, save energy, money, and
do it safely.
Thanks again.